to Upzoned, your podcast of the week to talk about anything related to the Strong Towns conversation. Usually that has something to do with policy, development, the built environment. Today we're actually going to talk a little bit more philosophically. I have an article here from the New York Times that I think is pretty fantastic. It's called Congratulations, Your Study Failed. And as always, you can read it yourself by clicking in the description for this podcast. And it is talking about our human relationship to failure. And while it's specifically focused on healthcare and the scientific method, I thought it was super relevant to a lot of the things that we talk about at Strong Towns. Chuck is here with me. And Chuck, you actually wrote an article kind of on the same topic, coincidentally, earlier this week. Could you tell me a little bit about how you wrote that piece? And then we can talk a little bit about how our friends in the sciences are dealing with the same problem.
I will. I'd be happy to. And I'm going to give you the inside story too, which I did not write on the piece I wrote Monday. So my wife is a brilliant reporter. She's an amazing person, and she works for Minnesota Public Radio. In 18 years prior to taking the job at NPR, which she did like 2.5 years ago, she worked for the St. Cloud Times. And in both places, she's working in central Minnesota. One of the biggest stories of my life in central Minnesota has been the kidnapping of Jacob Wetterling, this young boy who was, I want to say like 11 when he was taken, walking home with his brother and a friend, and someone came out of the woods at gunpoint and took him and sent the other two kids running, and they never found him. And this has been like an ongoing story that she has been in the middle of, not only as like a young person with me kind of living through it, but then as a reporter, like her entire reporting career has been around the story. And they solved the case. They arrested someone. He ultimately confessed. And in the last week, they released all the records now. So in Minnesota, we have this law that says once the case is closed, the police can't essentially hide what they did. They have to make all the records public so that you can go and essentially see what happened in the case. And in this instance, they did something amazing, something that was just mind-blowing. And she was there, like the photos of this whole presentation, she's sitting there in the front row with her recording equipment. And she comes home and she's like, "You're not going to believe what I just experienced." This sheriff, who is the interim sheriff, so the sheriff that was around for a lot of the investigation, has resigned and moved on. He's, I think, retired, actually. But, you know, it was kind of, this whole thing didn't go well. So he's gone. They have an interim person while they're waiting for another election now to name the next sheriff. And he got up and he had an hour-long PowerPoint, where he went through point by point by point where this whole investigation went off the rails. He's like, "This is what we did wrong. This is what we did wrong. This is what we did wrong." And I think, you know, it was amazing because you rarely hear government officials, especially in the police realm, public safety realm, be so open about how they screwed up and how they just like, these were huge failures. And he was extremely blunt about how bad this was. But he said, and he said this at the press conference, and he also said this in some follow-up interviews, "Look, we've internally discussed this. Like, we've learned a lot from this case and we've changed a lot of what we do, but there's more learning and more changing that needs to happen, not only here, but in other police departments around the country. And if we don't publicly talk about our failures, if we don't make our failures front and center, we're just going to repeat them over and over and over. And we're in a business, public safety, where people get killed when we repeat failures over and over. So we have to talk about them." It was one of the most bizarre press conferences, but it was bizarre because it was so unusual. We don't talk about things like this in public. We should. And you sent me this article from the New York Times. You can see in different realms, and you know, the drug testing one being one now, where I think people are starting to grasp that if we just pretend the world is all perfect and, you know, only like publish the good stuff and only talk about the things that work right, not only are we foregoing lots and lots of knowledge and wisdom, But we actually kind of seed an unrealistic version of the truth.
Absolutely. And, you know, I have to say I was particularly tickled to read your article, Chuck, because I've been listening to a podcast about the Wetterling case. Totally coincidentally.
You're listening to In the Dark, right?
Season two. Yeah. I missed it when it first aired. But that's what I've been doing while I do spreadsheety stuff for work. I listen to In the Dark. And I agree that it's a completely remarkable example. And it reminded me a lot of what we talk about at Strongtowns too, even before you publish this article. So I was really thrilled to be able to take it on. Some of the insights that the New York Times article talks about why that's so uncommon, I think are really worth a closer look than maybe we usually give this kind of a thing. So they talk in this article about the bias towards, they call it outcome reporting bias. It refers to writing up only the results in a trial that appear positive while failing to report those that appear negative. And they even give the example that in 10 of the 25 negative studies in this report, studies that were considered negative by the FDA were reported as positive by the researchers by switching a secondary outcome with a primary outcome or something along those lines. Why do you think we as a species are so conditioned to only report the wins and to only report the things that we did right?
I'm probably going to make people angry here by saying this, because we have in the last 2 years, and I think to our detriment in some ways, politicized science in a way that I've just been really, really uncomfortable with. And I think it's pernicious in two ways, because in one way we've said, science doesn't, you know, is not truth, and this is fake news and fake studies and da 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 da. And then on the other hand, we've said, you know, science is unassailable. Like the scientific process is beyond, you know, it's designed to get to truth. And when we have scientific truth, it's real truth. And the reality is that human beings lie behind both of those kind of conceptions of what science is. We publish things because we want them to be true, right? Like in some cases, when people are out doing studies and they really believe, let's give them like the benefit of the doubt. Like this isn't some evil drug company trying to ram some drug through that they can sell for a bunch of money and it doesn't matter the side effects. A lot of times it's just like personal researchers who are like, I really believe that this is going to help people. And I really believe in my heart that like these bad results like are not the results of like a bad result. It's just, I must have screwed up at some point in that thing, or I must not have like set the timer right on that, or maybe I didn't do it. And we just have a tendency to kind of heuristically fill in the gaps with our kind of positive nature of what the outcome should be. It's a really dangerous thing. There's that show now, I have not watched it, but it's one of the like American Idol-esque shows where they have the singer like behind the curtain. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I want to say it's The Voice. Yeah, where they're all in the chairs that are facing away, and if they hit a big red button, they can turn around and see who the voice belongs to.
It's a little bit like the way we've structured our interview process when we bring in new applicants. People who research humans, you know, psychologists and others have recognized that we have this bias when we're looking at, and I'll say this in maybe like a crass way. If you're looking at someone that your mind identifies as beautiful, you are going to hear their voice differently than if you're looking at someone that your mind doesn't see as beautiful. And I think the beauty of a voice is obviously independent of what your eyes see. It's all what your ears see. But our brains are wired to work in ways that produce these like weird outcomes. And so the voice says, hide behind a screen and we'll just listen to your voice. Our interview process says, fill out the questions and we don't want to know anything about your demographics or who you are or anything about you except how you would answer these questions. And I think in science, what we see here is that even despite the scientific process, when we want to believe in an outcome, our brains will trick us into finding a way to believe in that outcome. And that doesn't make scientists evil. It just makes them human, right?
Absolutely. Well, and I would say too, it's not just about believing in an outcome, but achieving what you set out to do. I happen to be reading this book that I picked up just randomly, honestly, at the library called The Antidote by Oliver Berkman. And it's about the way that human beings pursue happiness and success. It sort of purports to be the anti-self-help book. And it makes some really interesting points about what we do as human beings when we think we've achieved our objective. So the classic example is, have you ever noticed, Chuck, you travel a lot, that you can never get a taxi cab when you're in the rain, right?
Right, sure.
Yep. Yeah. So the reason for that, you would think, is that everybody needs a taxi in the rain. All the taxi drivers are out there picking up people, and it's just impossible to grab a car on the busy streets where you need them. What actually is true, and this is even true in the age of Uber, where we have surge pricing, is that taxi drivers tend to quit for the day when they have made the amount of money that they set out to make, right? They say, I need to make double the cost of my taxi medallion, or I want to replace a day's income with my Lyft income. And a rainstorm means that they can get off early. It doesn't mean that they're going to keep going and make a little bit more money, which sort of flies in the face of a lot of what we want to believe about market forces and incentives. So when it comes to something like city building, where we think, okay, our objective is to make sure that we show this amount of revenue growth in a given year, we kind of don't care how we get it. We don't care how long it takes for us to get there, if we did it in a smart way. As long as it is, you know, you were talking about confirmation bias in the realm of discovery. As long as it confirms our objectives, we're okay with kind of whichever path we want.
Right. We're very, humans are kind of wired, especially people who have these scientific analytical minds. We're wired to think, this is what my friend Joe Minicozzi says. He's like, we like to think we're Spock, that we, you know, rationally look at things and rationally evaluate things. And what we really are is like Homer Simpson with the donut. We're like, you know, want donut. And then our mind explains to us like all the reasons why we should have a donut. You see this all the time in, we wrote about a bike lane project recently. I wrote about it. And then, I think Daniel wrote about the same project, but from two different angles. And, you know, the thing is, I look at bike lane projects here in my hometown, my city planner and city like transportation people, they want to be pro bike lane. And so what they do is they go out and in the process that they're comfortable with, they like affirm all the reasons why they should have bike lanes. And what winds up happening is they build bike lanes where nobody's biking or where they're not really all that helpful. And then in the areas where people are getting hit by cars and where people are trying to bike and having a really tough time of it, those are places that, you know, are tougher to work. And their mind didn't take them to those projects because, you know, that's not like the filter that they see the world in. I think to me, like the takeaway of this piece and the piece I wrote Monday, and really a lot of the reading that I've been doing the last couple of years on humans, is just that we're beautiful and we're flawed. And if you don't see like those two together and just embrace it, you're going to be completely frustrated and disappointed, not only by other people in the world, but also by how like your life turns out. I think if you can embrace the idea that, you know, our brains are wired to trick us into believing that we know more than that we know, we can be sure of things. You know, you'll be constantly frustrated in life. Unless you're one of the very lucky ones, you know, that like everything, you're King Midas and everything you touch turns to gold, which is like a very rare, you know, statistically possible, but very rare occurrence.
Well, King Midas isn't so lucky. That's kind of the end of that fairy tale. So
yeah, no, totally. Right.
Because he can't eat anything because everything he tries to put in his mouth turns to gold. So let's talk about how you avoid that kind of Midas syndrome. What advice do you have for, I guess, particularly placemakers at kind of any level of citizenry or government who want to learn to embrace failure, to celebrate what they learn from whether it's, you know, a failed police investigation in the case of the Jacob Wetterling case, or something they tried in a small bet or even a large bet in their city that didn't work out. How do you start cultivating that mindset?
Don't you think, I mean, there's to me, there's like a front and a back end of this, of that, of answering that. I mean, to me, like, I wrote about the back end in the piece on Monday, which was in the Army, we call them after action reviews. I think in the medical profession, they have a different way of phrasing that. But it's the idea that you sit down at the end in the Army in an after action review, you go out and do something, you know, overnight movement with a bunch of vehicles. I was in a transportation unit, so we, you know, do things like that. And then you sit down and you say, okay, take the rank off. So like the captain's no longer in charge, the sergeant's no longer in charge. Like everybody has an equal voice, and you can criticize people and it's not going to have ramifications. What the F happened out there, you know? And you go through and you hash it out. And, you know, I think our human biases come into that, but at least we're talking openly and we're getting a bunch of different points of view. I feel like on the front end, I think a commitment to recognizing how bias creeps in and really staying committed to essentially the scientific process, which is, you know, we have a hypothesis of how, we have a theory of how things work. We have an hypothesis on how to test that. And then we go out and we do an experiment to test the, you know, to test the hypothesis. And then we look at the results. The true scientific method is about simplifying things down to remove as much bias and white noise and background, you know, stuff going on as possible. And I think if we can think like that more, we will set up things differently and we will just approach problems very differently than we do now.
Right. I mean, that reminds me of something else I read in that book, The Antidote. There's a sense in our culture that we need to set really big goals. And if we aren't setting huge goals, then we're failing before we even start. And as I was reading about this, it made me think a lot about what we're asking people to do at Strong Towns, right? Which is kind of counter to human nature in some ways. Idea that what we need to do to make our cities strong is not to say we're going to be carbon neutral by X day. We're going to have no pedestrian fatalities by Y day. We're going to increase growth by Z date, but that instead we need to have a consistent practice of setting very small goals that might have a big goal sort of hovering above them, but we have to be a little less attached to that and celebrate what we learn by failing at those experiments just as much as what we learn and move by increments very slowly. That's really dang hard to do in a culture where we celebrate things like the Yale Goal Study, which was a very famous study where they took a bunch of high school graduates in the year 1952 and told them all, like three of them, to write down their goals and the rest of them not to do it. And surprise, surprise, the 3% of people who wrote down their goals succeeded in everything. Turns out that study was fake. Yeah. That study never existed. Mm-hmm. But we've all been raised with that idea that what we need to do is use the power of the secret or visualization or mantras or what have you to achieve something specific. How do you let go of that and start embracing smaller ways of growing and moving forward?
There's an article that Malcolm Gladwell wrote. And if I said this changed my life, I would not be exaggerating. It was the article, and I've quoted it a number of times and shared it. It was one about Nassim Taleb and Victor Niederhofer. And what it did, I had read like Taleb's Fooled by Randomness and Black Swan before I got this article. And I found them very interesting and I struggled with them and I thought about them, but this article like really drove home the core points in a way that just flipped my brain to a different way of thinking. There's one little part of this that he said, he talked about like Warren Buffett. We all like would go get investment advice from Warren Buffett because clearly Warren Buffett is an investment genius. He started with nothing, selling cans of pop on the corner, and now he's a billionaire. And so just by that sheer fact, the guy must know what he's doing. And if we all just copied Warren Buffett, you know, we could all be successful. And what Gladwell points out is that, you know, how do you know that that's true? How do you know that that's not just like dumb luck? And he goes through this thing where he talks about, you know, like if you take a sample size of like 10,000 people who are traders and you say every year, half of them make money by random and half of them lose money completely by random. And you run that scenario every year. After like a decade, there's only like two or three people that have made money every single year, all by chance, all by random, but there will be two or three people. Are those two or three people genius, or are they just like the lucky ones who like things happen statistically to work out? In a country of 300 million people, you're going to have like individuals who can stand up and say, you know, I'm at the pinnacle and then here's the things that I did, with discounting like the whole way, the randomness of luck, the randomness of like good fortune, the things that are like essentially not repeatable. What is repeatable are the little steps along the way. And I think everybody's path is going to be different and everybody's pinnacle is going to be different and everyone's ending place is going to be different. But that process of taking the small steps and learning, that's what's repeatable. That's not the part we ever focus on, because that's like, you know, the tough part, right? You don't ask someone to write a book of the 20 times you failed and then the 40 like tiny little iterative steps you took. No, write the book of like how you're awesome. And I don't read any of those books for that reason. I find them completely implausible at this point in terms of being like explanatory, you know, of like, here's the path I should take.
Absolutely. And, you know, you are correct in that read of it, because the most likely person to buy a self-help book is someone who has already bought a self-help book and right. It has failed to change their life. So right. That's what I learned. So let's take it to the down zone. I really appreciate this conversation, but I also want to hear what you've been watching on television and listening to on podcasts and reading this week, Chuck.
Oh, I've been out on the road, so not as much like, you know, TV or anything. I did actually, I'll say this, my wife and my oldest daughter both had birthdays at the end of last month and early this month, and they wanted Hamilton tickets. Hamilton came to Minnesota for six, 7 weeks, and they wanted to go. And I had gotten in like the lottery to get tickets. And so I thought, I'm going to get my family tickets. I did not, like, I was in like the group that got to order them first. They were all sold out by the time I got in, which was like 5 minutes after it went on. I was so depressed because they really wanted them. I've kind of stayed away from the Hamilton thing, and there's a bunch of complex reasons for that. And I was prepared to be like, yeah, this is nice. You know, this is good. We went last Sunday before I flew out of town to Baltimore. That I still have it buzzing in my head. That was the most the 3 hours of absolute genius, the most genius that I have seen since I can remember. I was thinking like since I saw like Leonardo da Vinci paintings in person, like this was artistically, culturally, just a sheer 3 hour joy of genius. And when I got done with it, I just wanted to go somewhere by myself and cry for like 2 hours. It was so overwhelmingly good. And so if you're one of these people who is like, you know, I don't know if this is for me, or I'm not sure if I'm going to like it, do what you can to get there. We were in the very last row in the third deck on the far side. So we were like the furthest possible from the stage you could be, and it blew me away, and you know, and my kids and my wife. So it was a great experience.
Chuck, I'm super glad that you are also a closet musical theater nerd. I'm a big Hamilton fan and am known to sing the Eliza parts alone in my bedroom. So for my entry into the down zone this week, I would probably talk about Michael Moore's new documentary, Fahrenheit 11/9, which purports to be a documentary about how Trump got into office, which to a lot of people was completely unimaginable before it happened. But I think what was most interesting about it is there's sort of a inset mini documentary about the Flint water crisis that takes up about half of the runtime of the film. And it makes some fascinating points about how a not democratically elected government, because Michigan was famously under a state of emergency for a while by the governor, and he appointed new mayors in Flint, in Detroit, in other major cities throughout Michigan, was able to strong arm through an unnecessary infrastructure project under the illusion of growth. And this is in addition to the fact that something we talked about on Strong Towns a lot, Flint's pipes were corroding. They were leaching lead into the water supply. And how complicated that issue was. I would be really curious to hear what Strong Towns advocates think of this film and Michael Moore's portrayal of it. Well, that's our show. Thank you so much for tuning into Upzoned. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes and tune in next week and every other week to hear more about what Chuck and I and some celebrity guests be announced in the coming weeks have to say about the world of Strong Towns from the week before. If you would like us to continue making this program, you can show your support by becoming a member of the movement at strongtowns.org/membership. All right. Thanks so much.